Sushi Nami is Texarkana's new Japanese restaurant.
So we offer a regular menu and also all-you-can-eat. So the all-you-can-eat includes a self-serve buffet and make-to-order menu. The secret to good sushi is if you are a sushi lover, I would always recommend like go for the sashimis. Yeah. So raw fish are usually always the good ones. But we do also serve like special rolls. We also do like a variety of sake and beers in the store. We hope that we can serve the Texarkana local people.
Sushi Nami is at 4320 St. Michael Drive. Visit sushinamitexarkana.com. That's sushi, Nami, texarkana.com. Hello and welcome to On the Line. I'm Carl Richter. This week, Representative Nathaniel Moran returned to the studio for his second On the Line interview. He's in his second term representing Texas' 1st Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives. We talked about his priorities, his reflections on his tenure so far, the separation of powers, and he answered some questions from readers. The congressman was candid and forthcoming in his answers, and I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. Here I am with Representative Nathaniel Moran. Joining me once again in the studio, it's Representative Nathaniel Moran. Hello, welcome.
Hey, Carl. Thanks for having me today. Looking forward to our conversation. It's always great to be in Texarkana.
Yeah, what brings you here today?
Well, today in particular, we're meeting with businesses along the way, talking to them about some of the impact of the policies that are coming through with the new administration, and then also making a lot of stops with the schools, because you probably recall that schools are really important to me. And as a member last session of the Education Workforce Committee, I spent a lot of time in high schools and our colleges and universities. And today we hit three local schools, actually talked to their broadcasting folks and some of the government classes, and just chit-chatting about what life is like in D.C. and also helping them to understand how they can apply to the military academies and some of the art competitions and app competitions that we're doing, and how they can get involved in government.
Okay, great. You brought up businesses. I wanted to start with the economy. Headlines today is that the stock markets are down again. People are blaming both the president's tariffs and his comments on the Fed chief, Chairman Powell. Are you in support of the president's tariffs? What are you hearing from local businesses about them?
Yeah, so let me react to the markets up and down. Those of us that have watched the market for years, as you have, you know that markets react to uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think that they're reacting to, is they're just not sure what the next step is going to be or what the next activity is going to be. And so the uncertainty is causing some up and down. And in the last month, we've seen a lot of down. And that's not what we want to see. We want to see the trend up, no question about that. As it relates to the tariffs and the president's activities towards the tariffs, what I've said since he was elected and even before he was elected is, as a short-term negotiation strategy, I fully support what he's trying to do. The end goal for him is reciprocity. Mm-hmm. And we need more reciprocity with our trading partners around the world. We need freer trade with fair countries. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be the end goal with the Trump administration. You've already seen 75 plus countries come to the table and say, hey, President Trump, we want to negotiate. We recognize that we have a lot of tariffs and a lot of non-tariff trade barriers against the United States and U.S. products and services, things that we, you know, have kind of seen built into our markets and our prices for years. But it's true. These other countries around the world have unfairly kept some of our products and our services out of their countries. So if there's a reset and there's reciprocity and we get to an endpoint where there's freer trade with those fair countries, boy, I'm all in favor of that short-term negotiation policy. What I have expressed concern about is tariffs as a long-term economic policy. I come from a Reaganomics background, and I subscribe to Reagan's economic policies, and freer trade is better mm-hmm. because we know that tariff is just a nasty word for a tax. Mm-hmm. It's just a bigger word for a tax. And ultimately, the entity or the person that pays the tax is the consumer. It's not another country. It is the end consumer in the United States. And so I have expressed concern about tariffs as a long-term economic policy because ultimately our consumers and those here in Texarkana and around Northeast Texas would see inflationary prices. And we do not want to see that. So if the president is successful using his strength of the Oval Office in getting these other countries that are our allies, our partners, to bring down their tariff barriers and their non-tariff trade barriers, that's great. And I think he will be. But long term, I don't want to see the tariff stay in place because I think that will hurt some of our businesses locally and be difficult. Having said all that, I think what businesses really want is they want certainty. They want to know what's going to happen. Are we going to have tariffs? Are we not going to have tariffs? They need, you know, businesses don't plan week to week or day to day. They plan year to year or decade to decade, right. Especially the bigger ones. The bigger you get, the longer out you need to plan your investments. So we've got to be able to have certainty for our businesses to be able to make those long-term decisions. And right now there's just not certainty. And that's why you're seeing the stock market up and down. That's why you're seeing, I think, some businesses with some difficult situations.
Congress over the decades has given that power to the president to levy tariffs. You're on the Ways and Means Committee. Do you ever see Congress sort of clawing that back and maybe reassigning itself those duties?
Yeah, and we should. And I don't know that I would necessarily agree with the premise that we've given away the tariff powers. The most recent tariff executive order, in large part, was based on a thing called IEEPA, which is emergency powers for the right. president. And well, you know, the emergency declared by the president under that executive order was trade deficits with other countries. And I think there will be some judicial vetting of whether or not that's appropriate across the board. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that plays out in the courts. There's already been some challenges on that. We have, by, I think, inaction, allowed the executive branch in a number of different areas, both Democrats and Republicans, to exert too much executive authority. And we need to take that back, no question, and reassert that strongly, not just in the area of trade and tariffs, but in every area. Because here's the thing we really want to think long term about is, even if we all agree on the end goal of what's going to happen, you want it to happen in the right way. Why? Because if you support the use of executive authority under this president and then this instance, then the next president, which may be of a different party, is going to have the same executive authority to undo it
right.
and to do something different and go a different direction.
You're anticipating my next question.
Yeah, and so that's what we don't want to see. We want to be consistent with the application of authority and rule of law and separation of powers so that whether or not it's a Republican in office or a Democrat in office, we are okay with that scope of authority given to the executive. And I said when I ran for office many years ago, and I will continue to say, the executives, both Republicans and Democrats, for decades now mm-hmm. have exercised way too much authority and intruded into the Article I legislative branch's responsibility.
I think a lot of people will be relieved to hear that because there's an impression out there that the Republican Congress is more or less just following Trump blindly. What is your impression there? Can you reassure people what sort of lines are there for you about the separation of powers?
Well, certainly I would say that we're not following blindly, but mm-hmm. you know, we're 3 months into the presidency. We're doing this interview on it's like the 21st of April, I think. So we're almost exactly 3 months into the presidency. Mm-hmm. There was a clear mandate in November by the election. I mean, it was just an overwhelming mandate in the election to see a sea change in government. And we want to be supportive of that mandate given by the American people. But so there is deference given to that objective, no question about that. But we are certainly communicating and have communicated in hearings, Republicans and Democrats both alike. But since your question relates to Republicans, we have communicated. We've got some hesitation on some of these things. Mm-hmm. Let's not cut with a chainsaw. How about we cut with a scalpel? Mm-hmm. And let's change the things that need to be changed. No question there needs to be. Let me give you an example. An analogy. I was talking to somebody about Doge. They were asking me about Doge, mm-hmm. and about all the things that are going on there. And one of the things I've been telling folks is your initial response should be to relax, not react, for this reason. It's springtime. In East Texas, we do a lot of spring cleaning. I did some this weekend for my wife. Yeah. But the only way to do real spring cleaning, and there's a lot of spring cleaning that needs to happen in D.C., is you can't just sweep around the things in the garage. That would be a mistake. That's a rookie husband mistake, is to go out in the garage and sweep around the things in the garage. What you got to do is you got to pull it all out, put it all in the driveway, sweep every corner, look at all the stuff in the driveway, decide what you've used, what's useful, what still works, what needs to go back in the garage, and then decide what needs to be disposed of and go on the curb and go to the dumpster. And that's what Doge is engaged with. That's what I think President Trump's tactic is pull it all out. And while it's all pulled out, we all get a little nervous. Man, there's a little bit of chaos there. But some of this stuff is going to go back in once there's a vetting of what needs to happen and what doesn't. And then the waste, fraud, and abuse is going on the curb, and it's going to get disposed of.
We're talking about people, though, you know, people's jobs, many of whom are veterans. I think there was a reaction to the initial Doge push just because it seemed sort of callous and cruel to people. And, you know, you've got Elon Musk dancing around with his chainsaw gleefully, you know, firing so many people. You know, what do you have to say to those people?
Well, first of all, he didn't fire anybody. He made recommendations to the cabinet members that ultimately made decisions. Mm-hmm. And they were giving people outs, a chance to retire early. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, there's been some activity that feels more like cutting with a chainsaw than with a scalpel. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I think there has been some refinement since we first started in late January till now. And they're going about it a little bit slower pace and a little bit more of a refined cutting now, because mm-hmm. they've learned some lessons. They put out some executive orders and then they had to pull them back because initially they hadn't really thought through the implications of all of that. Mm-hmm. So there has been a learning curve there. And I'm glad to see that learning curve, because we don't want to be overly broad. We don't want to see that overly broad sweep out there. But truly, the case is there is so much waste, fraud, and abuse within government operations. And there are so many people that, frankly, had not even shown up to work in years. I mean, that's not hyperbole. You've been around me enough to know I don't engage in hyperbole. I don't throw political bombs. It's not my personality. I just don't do that. I really want honest discussion and solutions. But, man, I got to tell you, there's a lot of people up there that are in government work that just haven't been doing squat for about 4 years. And they need to be out of government. We're paying them to do something that they're not actually doing. And government really can work more slimly and should focus more on their core responsibilities, because we're in a position now where we got $37 trillion of debt. And we're looking to trim spending in a lot of different ways. And immediately, as soon as you talk about trimming spending, people will say, hey, you need to cut spending. The government needs to quit spending so much. But the moment you identify an area that's actually going to get cut, then people start freaking out. And they're like, well, don't cut that spending. Mm-hmm. Well, which spending do you want us to cut? If we're really going to solve the problem of too much spending in Washington, D.C., it's going to actually impact every community, and it's going to impact every family in some way. What we want to do is be able to do that in a way that still provides money back to those families and those small businesses in their back pocket through tax relief, and then cut the wasteful spending so that the true impact is minimized.
Along the same lines, I wanted to ask you about something I've been reporting on here locally, which is the president's executive order that basically stripped many federal employees of their collective bargaining rights, including some federal prison correctional officers here and those who work at Red River Army Depot. Are you aware of this? Have you talked to anybody in the unions? And just sort of generally, where are you about unionizing a federal employee?
Well, this issue has not been top of the line in our office. It hasn't come to us in a way from the unions that they haven't expressed huge amounts of pushback on that. We worked with Red River Army Depot on some other issues because we want to make sure that we continue to grow the operations of Red River Army Depot, that we grow the influence. It's one of only, you know, two depots in the nation that do what needs to be done in rehabbing military equipment and, frankly, bringing better value to our military operations, saving taxpayer dollars. I mean, the list is endless, really, on the positive effects that Red River Army Depot has. And I think we sufficiently got ahead of that issue, which was great. On the collective bargaining front, you know, you got to remember that when public employees collectively bargain, they're effectively bargaining against the taxpayer. I mean, that's really what's happening. And so I don't know that there's I think you got to be real careful when you step into the public union realm of saying, well, we want to make sure that they are able to bargain more heavily against the taxpayer. No, I don't think that's right. I think there's a lot of value in making sure that there's a great wage and a great ability for those folks to retire when they need to retire and show appreciation to them for service to the nation. Absolutely. But you know, we just haven't we haven't engaged the president on that issue. That issue hasn't gotten to our office to a level where it's one of the top things. We've been focused on trade and tax is what we've been focused on because we're on the Ways and Means Committee. So I'm happy to look at that issue some more as folks are concerned with that. Happy to do that.
I wanted to get some questions from our readers. First of all, from Garrett. He asks, why do Republican lawmakers such as yourself refuse to hold in-person town halls, even as the Trump administration condemns remote work for federal employees, even going so far as to fire those workers? How is relying on Zoom meetings and pre-screened questions from friendly media outlets not a glaring double standard, one that prioritizes political convenience over direct accountability to constituents? Do you have any room to improve with just meeting with folks?
We're always looking to do that. So yeah. I want to answer this question. I'm so glad Garrett asked this question because to suggest that what he did in his question, the premise of us just doing friendly media outlet questions, I mean you're free to ask whatever you want to ask. You're obviously asking whatever you want to ask. Mm-hmm. And I hope that's the case. Mm-hmm. We did a teletown hall a couple weeks ago. And if anybody listened to that, and if Garrett did, I hope he did. The first like 5 out of 6 questions were obviously for people that were not friendly to us. They were mm-hmm. asking us tough questions.
Yeah.
And that's what we wanted. We wanted tough questions. And we do a lot of teletown halls when we're in D.C., And actually to suggest that we don't hold in-person town halls is actually a complete fabrication of the facts. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the first term of when I served the first 2 years, we held I would be willing to put up my number of in-person town halls and forums and speeches and engagements against any member of Congress, Democrat or Republican. We did a ton of them. Mm-hmm. And we counted up when this issue came up here a couple weeks ago, somebody asked us about it. We counted up 20 such events between August and the end of the year that we did town halls, forums, in-person events where there was open public Q&A that was open to the public. It wasn't a private event or a closed event. It wasn't anything like that. And 20 of those events and from August until the end of the year, that's a lot of opportunity for people to get in front of us and engage with us. And that's what we want. And we do. We go beyond that. We actually sit down and have constructive dialogue like what I mentioned earlier with businesses that are concerned about what's going on. And so we don't pre-screen out hard questions. We don't just do softball interviews with media companies that are quote unquote friendly to us. I think the first couple of years I was doing more interviews on NPR. I remember the NPR folks, both here in Texarkana and Tyler, saying, wow, we've actually never had a member of Congress that was willing to sit down with us.
Right.
And I said, well, you should. I mean, we're here to answer questions. We're accountable to both Democrats and Republicans. So we do a ton of them. I actually have one tomorrow night, by the way, in Tyler. And we're expecting hundreds of people. And another,
I should say this won't be out before then, but just to make the point.
All right. Yeah. So, I mean, so and the other thing to consider is actually if you look at the congressional schedule, and this is really important, it's front loaded heavily in D.C. the first 7 months of the year. Mm-hmm. And so our opportunity to be in front of folks. Really, I'm in D.C. 3 out of every 4 weeks, generally speaking, and our opportunity to be in front of folks is limited. And this year in particular, working on the tax bill for Ways and Means Committee, we spend extra days in D.C., not just when we're in session. So we've only been, again, we're only 3 months into the year, and there's been very little opportunity, though we've already done some, and we're going to do some tomorrow. And we're holding next week a couple of What are budget workshops? We're partnering with a group called the there's a coalition group, and it's a nonpartisan group out there. I'll think of the name of it here in a second. That comes in, they do a budget workshop with hundreds of people. We're doing one in Tyler and one in Longview. That's as many we could schedule in a day and a half. The Concord Coalition is their name, and it helps individuals in the community go through a budgeting worksheet process, workbook process, as if they were trying to balance the budget. So it teaches about the budget process. Here's what I want. I want constructive dialogue, like the dialogue we're having, where questions and answers can go back and forth. There are a lot of things going around the nation right now, and a lot of people in the district that will say, hey, how come you're not having a, quote, town hall? What they really don't want is a constructive dialogue. What they're looking for is they're looking for a media opportunity for a protest. That's not constructive for anybody. And if somebody's I dealt with that on the county level, and it's not beneficial to anybody if you're just looking for your 5 minutes on TV. And that's happening around the country, by the way. I've got colleagues that are having trying to lean into the in-person town hall thing at the request of groups that are pushing, and when they get there, what they find is that they're getting screamed at, and they're not allowed to talk, and so that's not helpful to anybody. So the constructive dialogue is very helpful. Want to engage in that? Have already done that a ton over the last 2 years, and we'll continue to do that. Our perspective on how we serve the First District of Texas doesn't change based on who's the president. Doesn't change on what circumstances are going on. We are always in front of people, always. So I think people are just getting caught up when they're talking about in-person town halls, getting caught up in the nationwide kind of chatter about that.
Right. Where should people look if they want to find out where they might be able to talk to you?
Yeah, they should follow me on social media.
Okay.
And because on social media, we put all this stuff out. And by the way, we also put out a weekly newsletter. Mm-hmm. Which tells people everything that we're doing in Congress. We hold the if you get on the social media, you'll know about the monthly tele-town halls that we're doing. And if somebody listened in last time again, they would have found out probably 75 or 80% of the questions were not friendly questions. They were obviously from people that disagreed with what was going on, and they asked hard questions that needed to be asked and needed to be answered. And that's why we do that.
Okay, great. Another from a reader, Kevin in Nash, Texas, asks, are you at all concerned about the rise of authoritarianism and the erosion of the Constitution in the United States today? Examples, presidents past and present, ruling through executive orders, breakdown of separation of powers, undermining the due process clause, attacking federal judges, trying to control what universities and schools are allowed to teach, etc. You've sort of touched on this a little bit.
Yeah, we did. I think there's always a need for the legislative branch. It's the Article 1 branch of government. Always a need to keep the Article 2 branch of government in check, whether or not it's a Republican or a Democrat, doesn't matter. And both, as the reader correctly cites, both Democrats and Republicans, not just this one, but prior ones, every one of them, They all want to push the limits of executive authority. So this is nothing new. President Biden did it too. And we push back on him, and there's going to be pushback, I think, this term as well, to make sure that the president stays within his Article II authority. Again, people need to, I think, make sure that they're reading the executive orders that are coming out, because oftentimes a top-level press release or top-level talking point on both liberal and conservative news gets it wrong. And if you read the executive orders, then you understand more deeply actually what is being said and what the goal is and what authority is being exercised. But we're certainly staying on top of this as much as we can.
What do you see as your responsibility if the president, as he seems to be doing in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the deportee to El Salvador, simply ignores a lawful court order?
Well, we'll see. Again, you know, this is a district court judge that I think has really gone too far in what the intent is and of what order should or shouldn't be issued. But the president certainly should honor valid and enforceable final orders of a court. No question about that. I think it'll work its way through the court system, and they'll have to decide whether or not he did or didn't, or there was some member of the administration that did or didn't violate that order. And that'll work itself out. As a member of the legislative branch, I'm not going to get in the judiciary's role. I think they need to ferret that out, because the facts of that case are, frankly, only really known to those parties. And so you got to be real careful about prejudging both court rulings and reactions by the president in these areas, and let it work through the judicial system. There's an appellate process for a reason, and that appellate process will work itself out. I mean, we got a conservative Supreme Court, so and that is true to the Constitution. And I think if you let this play itself out, you'll see a reasoned opinion about where the constitutional lines of authority actually fall. Now, on the legislative side, one of the things that we have done, which I think is appropriate, is we passed in the House a couple weeks ago a bill that would go back to like a three-judge panel when we're talking about a nationwide injunction. So that if you're outside of a single person case, but a district court that wants to issue a nationwide injunction or has nationwide implications, it should go back to maybe a three-judge panel. And that's what this bill that we passed says. That was really the practice for many, many decades until I think the early 90s. And so that probably would rebalance where we need to be. If judges want to issue injunctions on the parties before them, that's one thing. If they want to start as a district judge issuing injunctions that impact the entire nation and impact foreign policy altogether, it's probably an overreach of what was intended for that judge to have the authority to do. And so by statute, we want to make that clear that if you're going to do that, you need to go through another process.
Do you think Mr. Garcia should be returned to the United States?
Again, I'm not going to get in a judicial stance where I'm not the judge in that case, and I haven't seen all the facts in that case. And so we're going to let that judge and the appellate process work itself out to determine what the law and the facts are in that particular instance. I think the overall goal of the president is correct, and that is, look, we've seen too much executive authority exercised to let people in this country inappropriately through the parole process, through just open borders process. And there needs to be a resetting of that. And I adamantly agree with the president's goal in doing that, in resetting our borders, because I think that was one of the big reasons why he had an overwhelming victory by the voters in November was, frankly, we saw no border policy whatsoever under the Biden administration. So, you know, if there was a misstep, the courts are going to work it out. And I have faith that the courts will work it out.
So we're almost out of time. What's next for you? What are you going to be working on when you get back to Washington?
Taxes. That's what lies ahead for us. Yeah. And the next, really till the end of the summer, is the reconciliation bill. It's super important because, you know, the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, most of those provisions expire at the end of this year. Some have already expired. And if we don't, as Congress, take some action next year, people will see the largest tax increase in American history, $4.6 trillion increase. I'm not willing to sit on the sidelines and do nothing about that. I think working families and businesses deserve to get to keep their taxes low and to get more money back in their pocket. I trust you and the families in Texarkana more with their own money than I do the federal government. I don't think we ought to be taking more. I think we ought to be giving more of it back, which means we got to trim spending, which is part of this reconciliation package, trim spending in the process so that we keep it deficit neutral over 10 years. And then in the process, make sure that the tax rates stay low. And by the way, keeping the tax rates low on the TCJA is not about wealthy people getting to pay less taxes. No. In fact, it's really about working families. They're the ones that benefited the most from the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. If you look at the numbers, they're the ones that actually got the best tax breaks from 2017. We want to keep that in place. I don't want to see a family of making $100,000, two workers, four kids, see their tax bill go up by $2,500 next year. And that's what's going to happen. Or a family with $75,000 of income, see a $1,500 increase. I don't want to see that happen. So we need to work hard to pass this reconciliation bill. What President Trump says is one big, beautiful bill. But we've got to do it responsibly. And that means cutting spending. That means also good economic growth tax policy that incentivizes small businesses like the ones that are impacted by Section 199A. There's about 90% of the businesses in this country, they'll see their taxes double next year if we don't do anything. Those are small businesses. Those are not the big corporations. Those are the mom and pop stores that have passed through taxation as how they operate. And if we just sit on our hands and fail in our tasks this year, their tax rate goes from about 21% to 43%. That's mom and pop stores. And that's not the big corporations. So big corporations, their tax rate is going to stay at 21%. We want to help the mom and pop folks. We want to help working families. And that means getting our job done with reconciliation process.
What do we have to do to get out of this cycle where every once in a while we have to have a showdown about whether the government's going to close?
Yeah, I know. I know. It's ridiculous, isn't it? And it's what's really ridiculous about it is that when you see it coming down the road, you're like, you know where it's going to end. And you say, why can't we just do our job and get the appropriations bills passed and get them passed on time? Yeah, I think the people back home are just going to have to say enough's enough. And we know that shutting down the government, it doesn't save any money. It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't do any good in the long run. And so I'm not for shutting down the government, but neither am I for funding through continuing resolutions. I don't like doing that because the military can't plan long term. There can't be changes in policy like we need to see. There can't be directed funding to projects that where we absolutely need to exercise those authority as the appropriators. That's the Article I branch to say this is where the money needs to get spent. None of that can happen really through continuing resolutions. So we don't need to do that. But that means working across the aisle. And sometimes people don't want to work across the aisle, which is unfortunate because in appropriations you have to, because you got to cross that 60 vote threshold in the Senate.
Right.
And so most people don't realize that. They're like, well, you got the Senate, the House, and the presidency. Why don't you just pass appropriations the way you want them? You can't. Because the Senate still got to do their thing. And there's still differences of opinion when you're talking about a House that's got, a three-seat majority right now. Well, you know, the guys in New York and the Republicans in New York and the Republicans in California and the Midwest Republicans, they want different things. Why? Because their constituents demand it. They're actually reflecting the principles and the values and the positions of their constituents, which are different than ours here in East Texas sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so you got to find a way to actually reach a consensus area so that you can get to that 218 threshold.
Well, we could talk for a long time.
I know more. We could. And by the way, I've enjoyed it. And thanks for letting me just kind of go on and on.
Oh, about absolutely. Things. We're here to hear from you.
It's great conversation. And I really want to emphasize again, I want people to your listeners to know I didn't vet any questions from you. I mean, I didn't,
no.
I, and I'm not going to, I mean, I didn't tell you offline, hey, you can't ask about so-and-so. No. I want you to ask whatever you want to ask.
Right.
And the people of Texarkana, the people of First District of Texas deserve to hear those answers and to have their questions asked. And so we're going to keep doing that as much as we can in constructive forums where you're going to have that dialogue. And you'll see more of that when we have that opportunity. But unfortunately, they keep me up in Washington, D.C. way too much.
Well, thanks very much for taking some time with me today. And look forward to another conversation soon.
My pleasure, Carl. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
On the Line is a Texarkana Gazette podcast recorded in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. Follow On the Line on our website, texarkanagazette.com/podcast. To support the show, post a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. And please, spread the word by sharing a link or telling a friend. I write, produce, and edit the show, and I'd love to hear from you. Email me at krichter@texarkanagazette.com and let me know what you think. I'll see you next time on The Line.